Good afternoon to the brave folks who have come in after lunch. My name is Cynthia Hallett. I am the past chair of the alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs section. And on behalf of the section, I welcome you to this presentation or this session looking at the elements of the successful Breathe Easy, Smoke-Free New Orleans campaign. I'm also the executive director of Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights and had the pleasure of working with sort of this is just a subset of the dream team that made up the Smoke-Free New Orleans Coalition. And how many of you were at APHA last year in New Orleans? Fantastic. How many of you participated in the second line rally in March? Great. Did you have fun with that? Cool. Because we want to look for those opportunities wherever possible. We're very fortunate to be in a truly 100% smoke-free Chicago. Next year we're going to Denver. Denver will be looking at other issues in terms of legalized marijuana, but just so you know, for the record, the marijuana use is not permitted in smoke-free environments either. Again, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section is having its awards reception tomorrow evening, starting at 6:30. So we invite all of you to join us at that. You'll learn a little bit about what happened at the business meetings here. For instance, there have been several policies in front of the governing council, which they will be voting on tomorrow. One deals specifically with preemption issues, not just in tobacco, but food, nutrition, alcohol, paid sick leave, etc. So we're asking APHA to take a position, basically being in opposition of blanket preemption that would prevent states and localities from working on anything. And there have been other ones on alcohol issues and on the TPP, the trade policy agreement. So all very sort of high-level, interesting things. But, you know, we are public health, and these are all very important policy issues that we're working on. So if you come tomorrow night, you'll hear how some of those policies fared. But most important this afternoon, there are a lot of different elements that go into successful campaigns. And this one in particular is going to be looking at, of course, the efforts that took place in the city of New Orleans. Louisiana as a state has a statewide smoke-free workplace and restaurant law, but New Orleans was very important first of all, it's New Orleans. Very special and unique, and also viewed as just this city with kind of a different image. The campaign that they worked on was critical for us in the tobacco control movement, not just because it's New Orleans, kind of this party city, but it included the casino there, which is immensely important as we're looking at casinos across the nation as one of the fastest growing places of employment. And so it was a very interesting test to see, can one work to include the casino at the local level and not just at the state level. Nationally, 20 states currently include commercial casinos in their statewide workplace law. I emphasize commercial because many states have tribal casinos, and as sovereign nations, those tribes make their own policies. So while there are over 800 smoke-free gambling facilities of one sort or another, casinos, racetracks, bingo halls, etc., most of those are in those 20 states which have the commercial casinos, and then there's maybe a dozen tribal casinos. So today we're going to hear about this convergence of both years of public education, the science around the hazards of secondhand smoke and the benefits of smoke-free environments, worker recruitment, and also just a solid political campaign. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our four panelists who are going to give this presentation today. We're going to save questions at the end. And just like any wonderful coalition, they're going to be sharing the time. There's one presentation. They will be getting up and transitioning throughout. But first, we're going to start off with Tanya Moore. She is with the Tobacco Free Living Campaign, which is at the Louisiana Public Health Institute, based in New Orleans, followed by Claudia Rodas with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, then Anjul Smith, who is a consultant with the American Non-Smokers' Rights Foundation, and Jennifer Kofer, who is currently with MD Anderson Cancer Center, but at the time of this campaign was with the American Lung Association in the Southeast region, and she will be presenting from her time at the Lung Association. So without further ado, Tanya, I turn it over to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. All right. First, let me just go through our disclosures. Actually, this is all of our disclosures, so I'm just going to quickly go through these. This lists Claudia, myself, Jennifer, and Anjul. All right. And we do not have anything to disclose to this group today. So, I'm up first, so thank you for having me here, and my CEO of the Louisiana Public Health Institute is also in the audience. Thank you, Joe, for attending and for also supporting the work that we've conducted over the last couple of years. So I'm going to talk about laying the groundwork, followed by the campaign, the vote, the implementation, and protecting the audience, or ordinance, I'm sorry. And most of you should have a data brief that may be on your seats in the audience that I'll discuss in a few minutes. So let's talk about laying the groundwork. So of course, a lot of what has happened and building up the momentum in New Orleans didn't just happen overnight. It took lots of years of educating the community just on the dangers of tobacco use, harmful exposure to secondhand smoke, cessation and quit resources available to the communities. Our organization also oversees the Louisiana Tobacco Quit Line in conjunction with the Safe Tobacco Control Program. And of course, educating communities about the tobacco-related disparities and how the tobacco industry targets communities, in particular minority communities. And New Orleans is definitely very special. I know everybody thinks their city is special, but ours is very special. And so there are just a lot of things, of course, culture, a lot of culture there. And there are ways to preserve the culture in a healthy way. And so those are the type of techniques we wanted, and the information we wanted to get across. And then also, along with education, of course, community engagement, getting out in the communities to talk about what we do. Not everybody wants to hear about tobacco control in the community, so we had to make it and tailor it to various audiences that we work with. So, of course, we do have coalitions. We have 9 regional healthy community coalitions throughout the state, and part of that was developing the coalition and also working with the coalition to also do a lot of community engagement throughout the community. We also fund grantees through our youth, through colleges, and priority populations. And there were several populations that we identified within the New Orleans area in particular to also carry out our message, and they also became our advocates on the ground. Just years of building these advocates to participate when it was time to execute. Also through smoke-free events, of course, we have to get creative. So lots of smoke-free bar events, lots of sponsoring festivals. In New Orleans, of course, there is a festival for everything. If the sun shines, there is a festival that probably deals with sunshine. And so you just have to, again, make it fun, make it creative, to have that public health message and meet people where they are, not necessarily you probably getting invited to their organizations or community events. Also, we have been privileged with offering strategic sponsorships or partnerships within the community. So partnering with various nonprofit organizations, big events that come to town to also spread our message, get the name out there. And of course, media is very key in helping us to get that message out and also framing the message to the audiences. And of course, partnership building. And of course, working with our national partners with Lung Heart Cancer, ANR, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and other local organizations and partnerships as well as building a great rapport with the City of New Orleans Health Department. That ended up being a very key relationship within this campaign. So also, we probably had about 3 or 4 campaigns since about 2008 that focused more on smoke-free environments and bringing awareness to the issue. So in 2007, in Louisiana, the Smoke-Free Air Act was passed, which also included, smoking was prohibited in all public places except bars and casinos. So this really led the way and the pathway to start working at the local level, because we didn't really see a lot of momentum at the state level. So we still have a long way to go in Louisiana, which is, this is why the New Orleans effort has been such a strong and unique movement to pave the way. So early on, again, just framing it around the culture that exists, we took a couple of musicians at your bottom left and right. The left is Craig Klein. Craig Klein is a part of a group called Bonorama. They're a great group. If you ever come to New Orleans, check them out. So he wanted to be a part of the campaign. Again, this was back in 2010. So he's been an advocate up until the day that the ordinance passed. He was, he had the great talking points. He had the experience to talk about how playing in a smoke-filled bar or room or venue was not pleasant to his voice. And also Chaz, who's on the right with the washboard. Any of you familiar with Zydeco music? Okay. So Chaz actually played in a smoky bar for years. And so there was this nice article that came out one Sunday in the entertainment section to say that he was doing his last show at this particular bar because he could not take the smoke anymore. And he was, getting older. Of course, those health effects from playing in that bar for so long was starting to take a toll on his health. So he said from now on, because he is a noted musician in the New Orleans area, he can now go and pick where he wanted to play. And he did just that. And he's also been very relevant to this campaign as well. So media, and then they like to see themselves on billboards. So these were on billboards, major intersections, and areas throughout the city. Now the top image, and of course we have the casino worker with the messages, of course, I deserve the right to breathe smoke-free air at work just like you do. That was very effective and impactful to a lot of the other musicians, and working with the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation, which actually trained musicians on talking points to become advocates for smoke-free environments, as well as some other health issues that they may need in the community. So they were very effective in working with us to get the musicians on board. So we're proud to work with them as well. And then the hashtag smoke-free NOLA. Most of you that were in APHA last year probably remember seeing that actual campaign. And so let's talk about some of the evaluation research, as I mentioned, the data briefs that you have in front of you. So we also, besides our communications team, we also have a great evaluation and research group who's able to help us put some of this information in perspective. So throughout the years, we've conducted the air quality in the smoky bars and casinos in New Orleans, and in your data briefs, you'll see the actual graph that shows the air quality, showing the hazardous level in the casino as well as the bars. And so on that graph shows very unhealthy and hazardous levels. This was actually very effective also to have that image to share with the council, to share with the communities, as well as the musician industry as well. And so most of these research, the information in the data brief, one thing about our community is they want to see Louisiana-focused research. And they also, especially at the local level, and New Orleans being such a tourism economy and place to visit, we wanted to have this information readily available. Also, in 2012, during Jazz Fest, there was a tourism survey that was created for those who were actually visiting New Orleans to actually ask them, would they still participate or come to New Orleans if it was smoke-free? Would they still visit if the casinos went smoke-free? And so overwhelmingly, we did see where people that visited New Orleans would definitely come, come out to the bars, go to the casinos, and to other venues that they feel that they would like to go to, but they did prefer that the environments are smoke-free. And also the impact of the Smoke-Free Air Act, as I mentioned, we did not see any negative impact on businesses in Louisiana through the restaurants. Actually, we saw an increase in restaurants, new restaurants in the not only the city but the state. And again, this is post Katrina, so we Hurricane Katrina that is. So we did see a number, actually more restaurants and bars now than we did before. And I forgot to mention, New Orleans has 514 bars and 2 casinos. So I know some of you may say, oh, well, my state has 514 bars. So that just shows you the impact or the depth of the work that we had to do to really get buy-in from the community and the legislators as well as bar owners as well. And then also we have samples of other lung function study that was conducted with 96 healthy graduate students going into bars for 3 hours and looking at their heart rate decrease within that 3 hours and about 2 hours after leaving those bars. So that was a very interesting study. It was compelling, and the city council was very interested to see a lot of this information. And so also leading up to the smoke-free ordinance, of course, lots of events, lots of huge events that received a lot of media. Smoke-free week one, July, it happened in July of last year. That's the first time that we really publicly talked about the chance of New Orleans becoming smoke-free. We did garner lots of media stories that during that time, lots of media interviews, radio, newspaper. Also, this is the first time that we heard from the mayor of New Orleans, and he publicly saying that he would definitely support this measure. That was huge because you want to use those quotes for later on in your back pocket. And our lobby team will talk about that. And again, Smoke-Free Week 2.0, which we did this in conjunction with APHA in New Orleans last year to really garner a lot of attention, especially you all that were visiting the city, to hear from you, especially, you know, dollars make sense in Louisiana, especially the tourism industry. And New Orleans tourism alone makes up about 60% of the state's budget. And that statistic came from the budget committee hearing last year. So that's very interesting to hear and then understand why people were concerned about the impact and what this could possibly do. And so, again, just generating a lot of stories, and we appreciate you all for participating. Also, we held a press conference with our champion, Councilwoman Cantrell, and also Smoke-Free Second Line. Some of you may actually see yourselves in this video because I saw a lot of you having fun last year. And also some smoke-free events. And we also partner with the local NBA team, the Pelicans. And there was a huge rally at the Pelicans game that year. Yes, we do have an NBA team. And they're good. That's it as far as laying the groundwork as to where we are right now. Anjula is going to talk about more about the campaign, and I'll be back up to talk more about some of the impact and outcomes since the smoke-free ordinance.
Hi. I have the really fun part because I have the most non-technical piece of this presentation, which is good because I have no technical experience. But I do want to talk about the campaign, and I'll discuss the coalition partners, the roles and responsibilities, our deal breakers, and how important they are to getting to your end goal, and a little bit about the media campaign. One thing that was really critical to our coalition and success of this campaign was really having a robust coalition and coalition partners. And if you guys have ever been part of a smoke-free coalition or public health coalition, you know that there are those traditional partners, American Heart, Lung Cancer, For smoke-free stuff, it's us, you know, Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Those are the folks that you can expect to be at the table for every campaign, right? So when we have those meetings and we show up and it's us and we're looking at each other, we are always there. What we were able to do with this campaign is to really bring together other partners. And yes, some of them were still public health partners, but we did get also some non-public health partners. And as Tanya mentioned, the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation was a really important partner. We were really blessed to have this group because they for years have been representing Louisiana's cultural economy, and that's the description used to describe and represent, you know, the musicians and the entertainers and the food and the music and the history of New Orleans, and the people and even the places that are part of that are sort of represented by this group. But especially this group especially represents, which was critical to this campaign, their public health needs. They fight for them for healthcare. So those folks who are getting sick by performing in smoky venues, they were sort of this advocacy voice for that group. And so they found, which was not always there, but sort of through TFL, this connection. We connected those dots. And I think that's important with every other partner that was brought to this table. Louisiana Comprehensive Cancer Control Partnership, the March of Dimes, which for a campaign that was really focused on covering bars and casinos, you would not see that natural connection, particularly with the group that's representing pregnant women and babies, right? But we knew and were finding out that there were a lot of pregnant mothers working in those bars in the casinos. And so was that an obvious connection? No. Was it one we could exploit? Yes. And we used that. And they had voices that needed to be heard and concerns that needed to be addressed. Ochsner Health System, which is a very powerful, one, employer, but two, public health partner in the state, and it's based in New Orleans, was really a good partner and helped give some leverage to our advocacy campaign as well. And again, Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living. But I've separated these two, and you'll see them represented in different colors, because for every coalition, for every campaign and coalition, there are roles and responsibilities for the different groups. And as Tanya mentioned, a lot of this really comes down to public health partners delivering that public health message. What is the value of this campaign, and what is it that we're trying to really change? And our public health partners did what they do best. They really made sure that people understood the dangers of secondhand smoke and the benefits of smoke-free environments, and we told that story from every angle that we could. And using the data that our public health partners gathered, whether it was the indoor air quality results, whether it was the lung capacity study thingy. Did I tell you I wasn't very technical? I don't have a public health degree. But it's all that stuff that we use, and it's not just having numbers come out of that work, but it's how do we translate those numbers and make it mean something to the people that we're trying to reach. And that's decision makers, that's the community, that's the media, that's regular folks that we needed to buy into this campaign. And so you'll see the split on some of these roles and responsibilities. And I'm harping on this. I don't know if you guys see my soapbox right here, but I have a soapbox. I'm going to get on it. I'm going to stay on it for a little while. But it's just really, really important. And we really have to make this issue matter. And I know that secondhand smoke and smoke-free environments doesn't always obviously matter to communities, particularly communities that need it the most, because there's other issues going on, and they'll come back and tell you if it's public health that they've got other stuff. They've got cancer and diabetes and obesity and other things, and we see that, right? We don't always see the impact of secondhand smoke exposure on our community. Or they've got issues around crime and employment and education and housing, transportation issues and access to healthy foods, right? We see that. And again, we don't always see the impact of secondhand smoke exposure. But it's an underlying factor in so many of our public health issues, and folks who are working in these environments, particularly in New Orleans' case, the folks that were working in the bars and the casinos were the most vulnerable. And we had to tell that story. And so part of our education and advocacy campaign really dealt with getting those messages out, using our earned and paid media to do that. And as a coalition, we worked on building a strategy around that, a timeline for getting some of these messages out and how we could use that information and the data that was being gathered by our partners to feed that out to the community. We used those events that Tanya talked about to really find ways and opportunities to reach the community and to have those touch points, because they really needed to be aware and to really know who we were, because we knew that the opposition would be really strong and powerful. And we needed for them to know that, the community to know that we were working on their behalf. Public opinion polling, really being able to say, because every decision maker would want to say, well, does the community support it, right? And we knew that we really had to make sure that the community, the numbers were behind this. And of course, if you guys have ever been a part of indoor air quality testing, have you guys done this in your communities? All the information looks the same, right? The air quality is like really, really high, really, really bad before an ordinance, and after an ordinance, it's like non-existent, right? And everybody goes, wow, that's great. Well, they all say the same thing, but we got to keep saying it. And it's really powerful for the folks that don't do this work to see it, because it is breathtaking, literally, sometimes, to be able to show that information. And so we had to partner with the lobbying arm of what this coalition and campaign needed to do. And that was having really lobbyists or people who could have that direct communication with council. And again, because a lot of our public health partners couldn't do that. And we know particularly like health departments and some of our nonprofit organizations can't do that communication. And if these two arms are not coordinated, if the education campaign and the advocacy lobbying campaign are not coordinated, there always is a point where the public education happens and then it has to stop. And if the lobbying arm is not set up to pick up the ball, or you guys have not been working in coordination, the campaign can drop. Because, you know, everybody gets to that point where they can't go any further. But our lobbying piece also included calls to action and robocalls and using our partners' advocacy tools, email alerts and Facebook ads. I mean, we used every resource, I think, that we could to get our messages out. But one of the other things that was really important is that this campaign was not limited to folks in New Orleans talking about it. We created a really big buzz in New Orleans, but all of you guys at some point kind of were touched by this campaign and participated in it. That AFA, as I've been told, I like that, I'm gonna have to use that. The APHA conference and sort of second line rally that we did last year really sort of raised your awareness about the campaign in New Orleans, and a lot of you guys tweeted about it, you posted Facebook pictures, you sort of spread the message. And so that's what we have to do in other communities as well. We cannot allow every community going through this to carry the weight of their own campaigns. We need folks outside of those communities to talk about it, to let folks know that others are watching. We kept telling our folks, people are watching. They want to know what New Orleans will do. And I also say, one of the things we did as an organization that A&R Foundation, or A&R did, is that we sent alerts out to our members. So if you guys are a member of A&R, you probably got one of those alerts that said, hey, send an email and let New Orleans Council know that you want a smoke-free New Orleans, that you won't be back to visit until it's smoke-free. You know, you enjoyed APHA but hated the smoke, and we won't be back. And it's those kinds of things that we could do because the ordinance was not in play, but also that helped them to understand that it was bigger than the politics of New Orleans, that is something that really had a broader reach. Our deal breakers, as you guys know, are something that every campaign needs to have the conversation around. And it's critically important to have this and to put it in writing, to pinky swear, to draw blood, whatever you need to do, so that everybody is in agreement on what you want out of this, what you will accept and what you will not accept. But what's really important about this is to understand what you're trying to get and why. And because when we're dealing with a campaign like this, it gets hard. We had a ton of fun with it. We can celebrate it now, but it was damn hard, you know? And so many of our campaigns get the pushback from decision makers in the opposition. They'll tell you, well, you know what? How about you just take this right now, and we'll get the rest later. So some campaigns that don't have, let's say, even bars or restaurants and stuff will say, hey, why don't you take bars and restaurants, and we'll come back for those casinos later. Well, how long is later? And where is your public health impact? Where is the population that you really need to move, that really needs that reduced impact of secondhand smoke, that really has the chronic disease, okay? Because if they're in that, let's say, they'll say, oh, you're going to get 90% of what you want, but that 10% you're not going to get. Well, God, dog, if that 10% is what we need. That's the people who need it most. But having this conversation around deal breakers and understanding that you may not get those other folks for years to come, it took 8 years after the 2007 law to pass to come back and get New Orleans. That's one city in a big state. And they're still working on the rest of the state. So you have to remember that, too, when you're having these conversations about getting to your public health impact. Our campaign branding, we had two tracks. You'll see two different brandings used. Our Healthier Air for All, and then also the Smoke-Free NOLA that had the fleur-de-lis and the trumpet. And it allowed us to sort of separate some of our activities, to really draw the line and give some cover between our education campaign and our advocacy and lobbying campaign, which really worked out well. But it also gave the impression that there were a lot of people involved in this campaign. They're like, wow, there's this Healthier Air for All group, and then there's Smoke-Free NOLA, and then all of our partners had their own branding on some things. And it really did give the impression that it was a really robust campaign, and it was. But we wanted to make sure that people understood the power of the people and the partners behind this campaign. We had some targeted outreach, and we created some branding around that too, but we understood that we needed to sometimes have different messages for different groups. And some of this needed to be discussed and represented differently, and so you'll see some of that representation here. And these are some of the activities. Tanya talked about a number of these things, but again, using these as vehicles to reach the community. What we didn't want to do was only talk to decision makers and not reach the community, and we didn't want to only reach the community and not talk to decision makers and key stakeholders. But each of these things gave us an opportunity, and you'll see some real diversity there. We did utilize the Pelicans game, the APHA conference. The Breakfast Roundtable was a social justice roundtable event where we were able to really translate this issue to other issues and make the connection. The LGBT event really gave us some pretty powerful reach and leverage with that community. The Bayou Classic is a big deal in New Orleans, if you guys know anything about HBCUs and SWAC football. But people come from across the country down to that. Our change.org petition actually allowed us to reach the people we couldn't reach in person. And how many folks did we reach through that? Did we engage?
In 3 weeks, 2,500 people.
2,500 folks in 3 weeks through our change.org petition. And again, it's not just one of these things, it's a collection of all of these that we needed to coordinate these activities. And again, Tanya talked about the Cultural Economy Foundation, a fabulous partner that really brought the life into this campaign and gave us the face to the issue. But you may not have this where you are, but you've got something that makes your community, your city, your state special. And it's finding what that is and engaging that in your campaign. And so with that, I'm passing the torch to Claudia Rodas to talk about the vote.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm actually going to challenge on Joel. She said she had the most fascinating part of the presentation, but I'm going to challenge her and say that my part is actually going to be the most fascinating. Because I think the day of the vote was really a culmination of over a decade of work, laying that groundwork, a lot of what Tanya talked about, all of the studies, all the work that a lot of the health department and non-advocacy groups do, all the education and the, whether it's through media or through the public, you know, doing public events, it's laying that groundwork. You know, what Anjul talked about is, you know, picking up the ball, having those advocacy groups like our organization and some of our other partner groups that can do lobbying, pick up the ball and move it forward. And it basically comes down to this, the day of the vote, right? The day that you want to make that policy change. So it was a very exciting day. We knew that, you know, January 22nd was the target date. We had actually heard from our council members, our champions, Councilwoman LaToya Cantrell and Councilwoman Susan Guidry, who co-sponsored the event, were one of the most strongest sponsors I think all of our organizations have seen when we've come back and debriefed about what was, you know, the greatest success. If we're going to point to one or two things that we thought really made this campaign was a success, it really came down to our sponsors. You know, we can do all of this work on the ground. We can do all the education that we want to do. But unless you have that strong leadership, you know, at City Council or your decision maker who's really going to make it part of, you know, history, basically, for New Orleans. This was part of history. They were on message. They were well-informed, accessible, passionate about the issue. They were on the same page with us. They were not willing to make deals unless they were, you know, talking with us and communicating with us. These were our face to the campaign at City Council who were going to put their, basically, career on the line for this issue. And I can really, truly, from my perspective, say that these two women did that for this issue. Before I go into the next slide, I remember the day of the vote afterwards. I was driving back to the airport, and the cab driver, I told him, you know, that the vote had just happened. And he's like, I know it wasn't a unanimous vote. And I'm like, yes, it was. I know y'all didn't get the casino in there. And I'm like, yes, the casino was included. And he looked at me, and he's like, that does not happen in the city of New Orleans. So it was more about just not, you know, just a smoke-free policy. It was about social change for that community. So it was a lot bigger than just this one issue. And we had our leaders at City Council who were just as passionate as we are on this issue that made this happen. So the day of the vote, January 22nd, you know, we've done all this work. Our partner groups on the ground, over a decade on the ground. We come in, run a campaign for probably, I guess, so about 9-month campaign when the advocacy groups came in and started doing that lobbying portion, laying the groundwork, let's start putting some plans together, funding sources, you know, where are we going to fund this campaign, and, you know, doing all that work is probably about a total of 9 months. We knew something was going to happen in January, wanted it to happen right before Mardi Gras. So we have this date coming up on the 22nd. I can truly say even 24 hours before the vote, we had no idea we were actually going to have a vote. So here we are. We have all our partner groups. Some of them actually, you know, either doing phone calls or some of them who can't lobby, but at the very least doing their education portion, really pushing to say we need to make this change happen, why it needs to happen. All our partner groups, non-advocacy and advocacy groups playing a role, again, a unified message that this needs to happen in this community. So here we are the morning of, are we going to have a vote? None of us know we're going to have a vote. All of our alerts are going out. We knew that there's a capacity of 300 people that are allowed into the city of New Orleans. 2 weeks, I think it was like 2 weeks prior to that, there was a public hearing. They actually had to ask people to step out. They weren't allowing more people to come in. It was 300 people on both sides, obviously, those on our side and those on the opposition side. So that morning, we had no idea how many people were going to come in. Was the opposition going to bus all these employees in as they had done in previous public hearings? Are our folks going to turn out on a Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to really show the power? So here we are with our, you'll notice, kind of a light blue turquoise shirt. And we are just asking our people, come on out. We need you here to show your support. That room was packed. It was packed with the majority of our supporters wearing our shirts, those wearing Healthier for All. You see the signs up there. We were there going to show that if a vote wasn't going to happen, we were going to let them know that we were not happy about it. Either way, that morning, we were going to show up. So here we are that morning. City Council does their introduction. And finally, our issue comes up. They give us 30 minutes on each side. Everyone has their, you know, their last opportunity, say their say. And here we are. We have no idea what's against. Still City Council, are they going to vote for this or not? You see a lot of movement going on in the back. Are we going to have the vote? So we start a previous presentation we did. We didn't have the opportunity to do here. But if, I don't know if it's on our website or not, but you have a chance to go back and look at January 22nd, the City of New Orleans, look into our sponsor Latoya Cantrell's speech that day. Very powerful, very passionate on why the vote should happen that day. And it just got the ball rolling, right? And she, and I forgot to mention, we had this one powerful speaker, a former casino worker, who came out and shared his story about how he worked at one of the land-based casinos there in New Orleans. And while he was at the hospital ill due to some of it, because of the secondhand smoke exposure, he was fired and he was let go. He shared his story, and I think after he shared the story, there was no way we thought the City Council could not vote on this issue today. And we came in thinking, well, I think we at least have the majority of the votes. We're probably about, I don't know, maybe 60% sure we had our votes to have, at least to get it passed from a 4-3 vote. We go in, Control does her passionate speech, and after that, each other council member starts speaking and giving their story. And so it starts off with our supporters saying, of course we should vote this issue. One of the council members actually cried up there. It was very moving speech around how he was going to vote for this issue on behalf of all his family members who had passed away due to lung cancer. I'm sorry, I get a little emotional. It was a very emotional vote on that day. Then our people who opposed us, council members, start saying how they're going to vote for this issue. And here we are, right, just holding each other's hands, like, is this really going to happen? You would have thought we won the Super Bowl that day. 7-0 vote, unanimous vote. That never happens in the City of New Orleans. I've had friends who live in New Orleans, work in New Orleans, and say, that never happens on a major issue like this. Never. So here we are, celebrating. That was probably 10 seconds, not even, probably the second, right after the vote. We're looking at them, we're like, everyone's yelling again, we won the Super Bowl. We are emotional about it. Very hard run campaign, a lot of sweat and tears into what happened that day. Camera crews everywhere, national, you know, I'm going to skip over here. This was the vote heard around the nation. There was so much attention that was received not only there in the City of New Orleans, not even in the state, but as you can see, we had in the Time magazine, or at least online, there was, everyone had their eyes on New Orleans and we knew it. So there are a few clips right there. So what happened immediately after the post vote? Mayor Landrieu signed the smoke-free ordinance into law less than a week later. Here we are with several of our partner groups with him signing the law. He had could have decided, even though he said he was supportive of this, he could have decided, who knew what, you know, politics and how they play, he could have decided not to sign the ordinance. So there he is signing. Working with the health department, which our partner groups like Tobacco Free Living, Campaign for Tobacco Free Living, with their partnership with the health department, they were ready to go and start making plans to enforce. What were they going to do to enforce this law when it came into effect? prepare for implementation on April the 22nd. And am I almost done?
No, I think Jennifer was going to do this part.
Oh, I am so sorry.
No, I don't.
I just got passionate about this.
No,
this is not hers. Hers is right here. Her starts implementation day. So I'm good. Go sit down, Jennifer. Who are you doing this one? I will continue. So what do we do right after the post vote? We were also watching attempts to weaken the ordinance. Jennifer can go a little more into detail about them, but we knew that there was anticipation of bills being filed during the legislative session. It was right around the corner starting in April. There was a lawsuit filed. So that was something that we continue to monitor to this day. The Louisiana Gaming Commission, that was something that the casino industry used their relationships over the Gaming Commission to do some studies and say that their studies showed that there was going to be an anticipated decrease, so they leveraged some of their state relationships. We are still even dealing with it was a different issue, but the City Zoning Commission, so there was one particular establishment who wanted to get exempted. So we were still dealing with specific language being changed after January 22nd. We had to monitor this other commission and make sure that the language that they drafted for this one exemption was not going to make a larger impact. We knew and we had heard that there were going to be attempts to introduce some type of casino exemption at the legislature, maybe either directly or indirectly through maybe some preemptive laws. And then there was this whole, and I don't have the time to spend around the casino leasing contract with the city, which was another legal way that the casino was using to leverage, some fear into their council members around the contract that they have with the city. To this day, we continue to monitor all of these issues. It has not gone away. So what I would say as my going away is just because the campaign happens does not mean that we can afford to go away. You need to continue to put the pressure on. You need to continue to, Tanya will share a little bit about some of the things that are ongoing right now. There's still a very strong presence in New Orleans. We're not going away. City Council knows that we are there for several weeks afterwards. We were there at City Council sitting down with our blue shirts and they came up and said, "What are y'all still doing here? I thought this vote already happened." And we're like, "We're not going away yet." And we have it. So I will turn it over to Jennifer Cofer so she can talk about all the things that happened April 22nd and on.
Thank you, Claudia. So it kind of gets gray because between January 22nd and April 22nd was a lot of work, but also a little thing called Louisiana Legislative Session was going on from January 22nd to April 22nd. So just want to put that in perspective that a lot of us came right off of this campaign into legislative session dealing with all the things that Claudia mentioned with preemption bills possibly being filed, any way the casino groups could work language into any constitutional code they can find, they were going to do it. And then something called a tobacco tax was introduced in Louisiana session, and we did get 50 cents in Louisiana. So we had two wins, although it wasn't a dollar, but we still had a win. But that brings us back to when the real work had to happen, because we had to make sure April 22nd was going to go off without a hitch. The last thing we needed to happen on April 22nd was the headline reading, "Smoke-free bars can't work," or "smoke-free casinos is going to kill the economy." So we needed to make sure that we did everything on our end, our due diligence, to make sure that implementation was going to happen and happen well with community support, with media support. The great thing about all of these organizations here is that everyone had media team that constantly communicated every week. I'm a bit of a process person to the point where I control too much about process, but one of the greatest things that made this work was our communication process. We met every Wednesday as a coalition and talked about the things that needed to happen the week ahead and what happened the week before. And then the media team talked about what needed to happen each week, because as we know in a campaign, things change. But April 22nd wouldn't have happened without all the wonderful people at this table, as well as the organizations that backed us up. So this is just a kickoff day. That's a small sign compared to the one behind us with the building. TFL and LPHI did a monument sign. What we're standing on is the ledge and the porch kind of to the Mercedes-Benz Superdome. So it was very well positioned. Everybody knows that that's one of the main veins that goes in the city on Poydras. But 4/22/15 was a really great day for the city. I do want to add in a couple things that didn't make it up to the slide that was significant. We did have town halls on January 7th, January 14th, and then the vote on January 22nd. That's three times that public health advocates turned out more than 300 people. And that's something we usually don't do very well. Just being really honest, been in community health work for 15 years, we can't turn people out sometimes on an issue that people are kind of apathetic toward. But this was something that it was such a community-based, community-driven, city council-supported issue that it was something people were not going to miss. And if they weren't there in person, they were watching online because these were made live online with the City of New Orleans. So that is kudos to this group to, again, turn out hundreds of people three times. And then for implementation day as well. So we celebrated with a press conference, obviously, and then we had a really big celebration in one of the smokiest bars in town, April 22nd, that night. It actually went into effect April 22nd, 12:01 a.m. So this group right here was at Harris Casino at 12:01 a.m. watching the staff go around with their cups of water, asking people to put their cigarettes in it and handing them a lollipop instead. And within 15, 20, 30 minutes, you could breathe. It was amazing how significant when the smoke went out within that hour, you actually could tell a difference. So we'll see a slide later with some science that represents that. But that was a really great day. It was a long day from 12:01 a.m. till the next night when we were celebrating again at one of the smokiest neighborhood bars. There's a really big difference between a neighborhood bar and a Bourbon Street bar. But we decided to go and have a celebration with a neighborhood bar. And that made a big difference because neighborhoods are a big driver in the community of New Orleans and the city of New Orleans. So one of the things as Claudia alluded to was you can't just leave. You can't just go in and do a campaign and leave. You have to continue to monitor the policy. So what we did was make some post-vote one-pagers, and the city council meets every other week or twice a month, so we wanted to make sure it was always present of mind. So what we did through the TFL website, people could make anonymous quotes. We've learned that with casino workers and some bar workers, they are not wanting to put their name in where they work. And so these are anonymous quotes. We kind of assimilated the highlights of some really good quotes. And we would leave these one-pagers on their desk for city council meetings so that they'd always be present in mind. We made sure, again, like I said, media was always aware of what was going on, but they're never going to tell us no when we want to buy an ad. So this was Sunday paper of the Times-Picayune on the right with all the coalition logos at the bottom. We made our appearance in this magazine twice, the week before and the day of, and it thanked each city council person. You can't really see it clearly, but above the logos is each city council person's name because it was a unanimous vote, 7-0, so all of them need to be thanked. No matter where they stood or said during that process, they all made a yes vote. The one on the left, the ad was online, and we did a lot of paid media online. A lot of earned media came from that, from our activities, but it was a great balance of paid media, earned media, and social media. Again, we had calls that were going into the council offices as well as the mayor's offices to say thank you, because it's not just enough to bug the mess out of them while you're in the process, but you have to thank them. And so we did just as much pressure on them to say thank you and have our advocates make those calls. Awards, there's still awards being awarded to some of these champions. I know the Lung Association, the Heart Association, ACS CAN, and other groups, I'm sure TFL, have all thanked LaToya Cantrell one way or another with awards. But we also made sure people were aware of what was going on through alerts, through our action networks, as well as in person. We had thank you notes also going in through our grassroots folks who were on contract working with us post-vote. So we had one group focusing on faith-based. We had one worker focusing on neighborhoods. And we wanted to have thank you notes going in for those 3 months every week. So with these 3 weeks, 3 months, excuse me, we decided where to focus the resources and time because a lot of us had to stretch our attention to other states or other campaigns, like I was mentioning with the tax. But we also collaborated with the New Orleans City Department of Health because they were the implementation agency. You could use the word enforcement. We like to use the word compliance and implementation because it's a little bit more positive than enforcement. But New Orleans City Department of Health was a great partner. We helped work with them with the creation of a toolkit. A toolkit was one of the best things we could do to leave behind with businesses, bars, and the casino, of course, didn't need our toolkit because they had it all handled. But with some of the other businesses in the language, we had hotels, hotel rooms and hotels that were included. So we had to print that many 500, 1,000 toolkits for every business. And so there was this mass mailing to every business in the city of New Orleans for these toolkits. But ongoing with that time, again, we had the presence at city council, literally, as Claudia said, if they saw one of us, they would run down and say, do we not know something going on? Because why are you here? But that's just good due diligence on our part as advocates, is to make sure that nothing happens. If the casino is in the room, we need to be in the room. If tobacco is in the room, we need to be in the room. So that was some of the things that we had to work with. We also had some ordinances dropped. One of the city councils didn't like penalties that was in the language, and before the enforcement part of the policy was put into play, he wanted to remove all penalties, and we know that that's not really best practice, and we had to work with him to let him see what some scenarios were of why we did not want to mess with the language at that point, and that again was dropped. Cigar bar was a whole different ballgame with trying to work with different businesses who wanted exemptions because they were special. As Tommy said, they are a special city and every person thinks they're special. There were lots of nuances. So there were lots of ongoing fights. We try to categorize this for you to put this in a perspective. Again, for a full campaign, you have the active before the vote, but again, post-vote is a lot of work. Collecting stories, lessons learned. We had people in Mesquite, Nevada said, what did y'all do? We want to do the same thing. And so we had conference calls, technical assistance calls. I know several of us have been asked to share our story with their city. So we've done that. And in March, like I said, we did the toolkit. In April, we did pre-ordinance air quality testing before April 22nd. In 13 bars in the casino. We had those toolkits mailed out. We were planning for the celebration night. We did a bar crawl through the African-American bars. Even though New Orleans is a melting pot of people, there's still parts that are specific to LGBT bars or African-American bars, and we knew that we needed to be targeted and hitting those communities specifically. So it was a nice bar crawl the night of the celebration for African-American bars. In May, we knew there were festivals, so we needed to bring awareness to the tourists who may not have heard that there's now New Orleans is smoke-free. So we were present at French Quarter Fest, Bayou Boogaloo. Sin Nights, sin doesn't just stand for the action of, it's actually for the service industry nights. So even the bartenders and bar workers want to go out and have fun after their shift. So these usually start at 12 midnight or 2 a.m. when they get off. So we had sponsorships for certain nights just for the industry workers, for the service industry. And then in June, there was post-ordinance air quality testing of the same bars that we tested in April and some more nights sponsored by this group, as well as festivals in through the summer. And making sure that we thank the hospitality industry. One thing that didn't make it to this slide either was that we worked with the Concierge Association. Concierge groups were huge in letting tourists know that we were now a smoke-free city. And so we had these nice pamphlets that were put on your seats. Andrew will hold them up. And they fit right in that rack card that sits on the hotel concierge desk. So we printed them for them and dropped them off at the hotels in the downtown area, specifically where tourists usually stay. So that was a strategy that worked for awareness for us. A couple things, as Tanya and Claudia are going to come back up here and talk about impact and outcome. I do want to thank Robert McMillan from Mississippi State University, who came and testified on what a sister state was experiencing with smoke-free ordinances. We had to really call on technical assistance from a lot of folks. TCLC looked at our language constantly. We had a lot of partners that really helped us. I'm probably leaving out a lot of people, but we just want to thank them publicly for the success of this ordinance. It was a lot of people and a lot of organizations. APHA last year really helped kick off the game, and thank you for being a participant in that. But with Roswell Park Cancer Institute, they did the analysis for Oh, I still have more slides. What the heck? There we go. Well, here's all the visuals I talked about. Here's the air quality data. I'll go back up. So here's pre and post. You can see it's hazardous. All of you probably have seen the EPA chart. So you can see a 96% decline in the indoor air, 96% from hazardous to good. Here's some visuals of the monument sign. Here's visuals in the airport for our media campaign. Here's the one I talked about with the Concierge Association. Here's the street banners. It's really important to do street banners where the tourists are. We did online and print, billboards, bus stations, leading up to it. If somebody didn't know smoke-free, and New Orleans wasn't going smoke-free on April 22nd, they really weren't paying attention. So I think I'd covered all this. Again, this was our audience. We wanted to make sure we were not just throwing money out the window. You have to be targeted with your message. This is my closing thing for you guys to take home. It wasn't just stats, it was stories as well. And it wasn't just about the message, it was about the messengers. So if whatever your issue is, if it's fluoridation of water, for if it's childhood obesity, your message is important, but it's also important to have the right messenger. Your stats are important, but it's also important to have the story. And so both of those things made our campaign a success, including both. We had the musicians that could deliver such a better message than I could ever do as a public health person. And then we had the people who lived and breathed it every day as a bar owner, as a business owner, speak on our behalf. And just a regular good old French Quarter citizen came out of the woodwork nowhere, and he was one of the most passionate people that we did not have to prep or, you know, ask to join a network. He just came out because he just said, it's right for our city, and this is right for the city of New Orleans to catch up to the rest of the nation, is what he said. So with that said, I'll turn it over to Tanya. Again, another message here for standing strong and what they did. And I'll let you talk about this since New Orleans City Department of Health has put together some complaints. Down. Yeah, there you go.
Right.
Start with that one. Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm back. So living in the city, of course, post-New Orleans has been very interesting. You hear your church members, you hear, not church and casino, let me, you hear your church members, your neighbors, your coworkers, and just people on the street talk about how nice it is to visit all of these venues now that it is smoke-free. And so it's always great to, as said earlier, to have those conversations with the people on the ground there. So post-ordinance, there are a couple of things that have happened. Partnering with the city's health department, as stated, they did a great job of really getting that message out to all of the businesses, not just the bars and the casinos, about the new ordinance that was in effect. And so far, working with the commissioner over there, there's been 33 complaints registered since April 22nd, so it's been a little over 6 months. And a lot of these complaints were registered probably within the first 4 months. It's been actually quiet lately. From the 33, 7 of those were from the same business. And there were 2 that were actually offices in which the workers there reported the manager because the manager smoked in the office. So that goes to show you people were paying attention to what was going on, and they wanted to report those persons. And then through this, there was a rule promulgation process in which through the City of New Orleans Home Rule Charter, this was a new process in which they had to develop an education phase, which was early in the right after the ordinance. And then there was the actual fine stage in which they could actually start implementing fines for those that were in violation. So far, I guess due to going out to the bars and the other business places, they have not had to issue any fines to date. And also, they were very instrumental. I know the coalition did put out a air quality monitoring press release. It didn't get picked up until the city's health department actually utilized some of the information, and that's when it started to make noise throughout the city. In New Orleans, when it's coming from the mayor's office or the city's health department, in which the mayor oversees, they report directly to him. It's news. So Again, sometimes it's the messenger. They were tired of hearing from us. So here, we've also seen impact on our Louisiana tobacco quit line. So this is the number of callers just in Orleans Parish. And so I know you have counties, we have parishes, but New Orleans is the only city within Orleans Parish. So it was easier to monitor and not look at any other cities in that area. So the blue line represents 2014. The orange line represents 2015. And what's interesting about this, as you see, there has been an increase in callers to the quit line, as mentioned earlier, through the thin nights where the hospitality workers are. The quit line has been promoted post-ordinance quite a bit through the city's health department. They have it on their website. Through the literature that we shared with the bars, bar workers, we actually, and I forgot about this part, we actually worked with the person who does the quality control, the health insurance provider for the casino there, as well as Ochsner has played, Ochsner Health System has played a large role, and through some of our other campaigns and outreach that we talked about. But what's interesting, and if you look in the blue area from 2014, that was a tips campaign rolling during that time in Louisiana, versus we didn't have any, really not too many campaigns running this year promoting the quit line, except the on the ground, again, through the city and community outreach. So this goes to show you the impact that it has had so far in New Orleans. Now, this is very interesting. This is when it gets tricky. This is where it gets interesting. And this is actually what has made the news in the last 6 months. And it's the casino revenue. So we, on this slide in particular, we're looking at the revenue from Harris Casino from December 2014 all the way to September 2015. We don't have October because it the month just ended Saturday, and it takes about 2 weeks for us to see what the October revenues are going to be. So in the orange column, these are the other casinos in Louisiana. There are 15 other casinos throughout the state. We're not Vegas, but we do have quite a few casinos. And as you see, even before the ordinance, Harris revenue wasn't that great, which was where some of the arguments and complaints about how this would hurt their business, if indeed the ordinance went into effect. So we actually have some other data that goes all the way back to 2006, post-Katrina revenue data, to actually see some of the trends throughout the years on what has happened, and seeing seasonal trends, actually, to see what months are usually lower, which months are usually higher. And these are basically in line with those seasonal trends. And so as you see post, Harris actually fared better than some of the other casinos, even though you do see some declines. But looking at post-ordinance, which you don't really want to look at April because it didn't go into effect to April 22nd, you can't really measure that month. So starting in May, there was a decrease. However, if you compare that revenue to some of the other casinos across the state, they were not the only ones who actually saw a drop in their revenue. Then again, in June, another huge hit for the casinos. Of course, the storyline read for 2 months, and they did a great job of getting that message out, saying that the smoke-free ordinance impacted their bottom line. And so, again, you know, our standpoint was it was too early to determine that. Looking at seasonal trends, they're always down in these months, and usually summers in New Orleans are very slow. But what happened in July? So again, tourism being huge, the Essence Festival, which brings in over 500,000. There were a lot of conventions in town that month, and the casino usually attracts a lot of out-of-state people, especially around events. And we also have analyzed some of the near casinos in Jefferson Parish that are still allow smoking. But if you look at the month of July, Harris had gross gaming revenue of $36 million. They were not the only the top grossing casino. their numbers were higher than they have been in years. And then they beat out all the other casinos, especially the ones that had been in the top one or two tiers throughout. Again in August, revenue declines again, and then in September we saw it increase again. Again, due to events, what's happening and what's going on in the city. So we're going to continue to monitor this. Overall, they've come out, reached out to us to even show some future plans that they have. But again, it is the gaming industry, so you just never know, and we will always be on alert of what's coming next. So, you know, stay tuned to some yearly trends to see what happens. This is football season. This is, another time for conventions in the city. We definitely hope to see revenue, as the general manager at the casino said, they're looking to also be in the black for October. So good news there. And also the impact of smoke-free New Orleans, was felt in other places. As you heard, it went nationwide, but it also tipped a lot of conversations in other cities throughout the state. So right after that, the city of Sulphur implemented a smoke-free ordinance in that area. And then in Hammond, Louisiana, which is not far, it's about 40 minutes from New Orleans, they also implemented a smoke-free ordinance. There were some other areas who entertained it. Due to several reasons, it did not happen. And actually, since then, Sulphur has weakened their ordinance. And right now, we're gearing up for Baton Rouge, which is the capital city, which will not be an easy ordinance to work on, as they have three casinos from three different management companies there. Less bars, it's about 140, but it is a melting pot for lobbyists of every industry, again, as the capital is right down the street from their council. But again, we're going to work that one to the core as well. Also, we've developed some sustainability plans. As indicated, having the coalition partners to assist, having some of the community organizers to make sure that this message is still out there, as well as just looking to see what other events that are already happening, not creating our own, but just really tacking on to what's already happening. And so Claudia is going to talk about the polling, and then I'll come back up.
Yes, and I'll be a little quick because our timekeeper has said that our time is up already.
Oh, are we good with time?
For Q&A, though.
Oh, for Q&A, yes, okay. Exactly. Most of our data is up there already, so if you'll notice, 78% number, 78% favor that the city law that extended, I can't read from there, that extended Louisiana statewide smoke-free law to all workplaces, including bars and casino. The 78% number is actually an increase from a poll that was done in December 2014. So I guess a little 6 months later. No, it's December. This was just done in October, so I guess 10 months later. It was 66% support in December 2014, and then it moved up to 78% 10 months later. You can see the rest of the data on there, and then the other one that I did want to share with y'all is that 9 out of 10 voters said that smoke-free bars and casinos are healthier and more enjoyable. So this just showed that, again, this was something that the public health passed, and this is something that the public health continues to support and are enjoying the environment. So
do you have a more slide?
Okay.
So just to conclude, because we are getting the international sign to wrap it up, the sky has not fallen. New Orleans is a viable city. The bars are full. They're packed. Just come visit us and ride around, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And this has really actually been a great asset. The new council that we, well, the current council that we have, and we've changed council a couple of times, they're looking to have a healthier new New Orleans, with keeping the spirit and culture of what has been there before, but in a healthier way. So that's just the only thing I wanted to leave you with. I wish we could have had the councilwoman here we don't give this issue justice because she's a very colorful, vibrant, and vivacious person who not only leads the efforts in this, but there are some other issues in the city that we're facing that she has definitely been vocal with, and I do see some other aspirations in her future as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm always the mean timekeeper, but we did want to leave some time for Q&A. And I just wanted to summarize a couple of things because, you know, Jennifer said it, and I've heard a quote before from somebody on Capitol Hill that said, data make you credible, but stories make you memorable. And I think that's, again, a lot of those elements were combined into this campaign because we have the science about the health effects of exposure to secondhand smoke and the benefits of smoke-free environments, but it was the people from all walks of life that really made this story real. And it is true that the casino worker with lung cancer who got fired when he was in the hospital really was that final tipping point. It's like you knew the balance was, you know, kind of leaning both ways, but then it went in our favor. A couple of things that they didn't specifically say. You know, when that city council hall was packed, electronic cigarettes were included in this law. And a good portion of that audience were those scary pro-vape, vehemently supportive believers that these are the end-all be-all. And they didn't understand we weren't prohibiting the product outright. You just couldn't use them in a smoke-free environment. But we were able to kind of quell that for a little bit. Also, Susan Guidry, who was wonderful as one of the co-sponsors, initially wasn't sure what her position was on electronic cigarettes. So again, going back to that, those deal breakers that Anjul brought up, as a coalition, everyone came to an agreement, they weren't there initially, that these are the deal breakers. All workplaces, including casinos, must be included. Electronic cigarettes have to be included because we know that it's a new form of indoor air pollution and they shouldn't be inside. And other groups took the lead on carrying some of those messages and met with Susan Guidry about why this was important and explaining the difference between prohibiting the product outright and just prohibiting the use in smoke-free environments. It took a lot of communication and a lot of dialogue, and I give a great deal of credit to the folks, particularly from TFL and Louisiana Public Health Institute, who had been working with the City Council for such a long time that they had a fabulous relationship and trust with those city council members. We're not going to get that everywhere, but that's why taking your time and doing the job right, and you can expedite that timeline now that we have best practices and these trends and experiences to learn from, but you've got to go through all the steps. You leave out any of those ingredients, leave a little bit of salt out of the soup, it's not going to be right. We've got to use all of the ingredients to make it work. So with that, questions from the audience for the panel. Yeah, Dr. Mercer. The billboards.
So I guess this is a two-phase approach answer. So our organization, actually, we have a media budget that we include in our annual budgets, and the budgets are usually large enough so where we can place these type of tactics. And with the coalition partners and their placing, a lot of that came from the war chest dollars or the...
You want to explain what the war chest is?
I'm going to let you explain what the war chest is. And some of the rapid response dollars that were utilized from all of the national partners and that pot of money there.
Go ahead. So when I worked for the Lung Association, I had the privilege of being fiscal agent from receiving rapid response dollars from the Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights on several campaigns in the Southeast. And so as fiscal agent for the rapid response, we did everything but lobbying. So we could educate and advocate, but we could not cross the line to lobbying, and that's where the war chest dollars, which are a culmination of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, ACS CAN, and the Heart Association, those dollars were meant for lobbying. So we had a little bit of everybody's money from TFL, to rapid response from A&R and to the war chest from the advocate groups.
And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation gave A&R Foundation the funds for this rapid response campaign. And so if you see anybody from there, tell them thank you. Because really, we couldn't have done it without that funding. And again, it's to provide additional assistance to specifically work on this goal of healthy communities through having smoke-free communities. And I think similarly with the war chest money. There was some funding from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and then funding from those other partners, American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, Tobacco Free Kids, and the Heart Association. So again, it's sort of it's a pooling. It's everybody coming together. But that's where some of the larger big dollars were. But then I think these other groups like LPHI and Ochsner and others had some other in-kind or other actual financial contributions that they made as well. Robert?
Yeah, I noticed last year that Harris has a clinic for the employees who passed on the first and second line walk. Is there any chance you get them their data? It'd be fascinating to know what's changing in the health issues.
We can try. I don't know if that's publicly accessible or if the...
That might be HIPAA.
HIPAA? Well, just some of the aggregate data. I mean, yeah, but we can ask. You don't know until you ask. Other thoughts, questions? Yes. Right. So that's actually, thank you for bringing that up, because it was interesting. On the day of the vote, there were, you know, some edits made, and that was one of the things that was interesting. So some decisions, I believe, were made in part, and this is sort of me as an outsider, but based on Bourbon Street as the example. And so there were, the model that was followed, there were these sort of reasonable distance clause of X amount of feet, and it kept shrinking and shrinking because, again, the density issue. And that does come up. Again, you need to know your community. I think that, you know, that ended up, if that had to be the one concession that was made, we could live with it, because bars, yes, casinos, yes, e-cigarettes, yes, hotel rooms. I didn't know for a while there's 100% of the hotel rooms have to be smoke-free. This is a new trend, and it's a popular one, but who knew that that was going to happen? So that was very big.
So, yeah, on the distance rule for the ones that we think about, like these bars, suburban streets, French Quarter, and all that, that was taken out to 0 feet. But it did continue to keep some distance rules around, well, there's some things that the state law has that have to follow down, like distance from schools and distance from public parks. So it has a little bit of that, but then it also, when we first met with the councilwoman, her intent was really just, or kind of, not her intent, but like what brought her to this issue was that there's a plaza, and so you'll have to remind me the name, remember that, is that plaza that she likes to hang out, is it the Cancer Plaza? And so every time she went by there, there was smoke, and so that's really kind of where her interest grew on this issue. So that maintained distance rule around some particular locations around the city, but the ones that we think about, Bourbon and French Quarters, that was all taken out at the very end.
Other questions? Yeah?
The tourism survey that you did, I noticed it was like 404 participants. Did anyone question whether that was a big enough sample size based on how many tourists would get each year?
No, no one questioned us on that at all. So they did question one of the public opinion polls, but that was it. We didn't get any question. It was a random sample taken from all tourists who were, you had to be from out of town and not local.
Yeah, and I'll add, I think in all of our campaigns, when there are those sample sizes, they question it, but don't discredit it. And here's the difference. I think the opposition or people who want to question will always raise that point, but it doesn't discredit the survey and the data, so.
And we were actually shocked to get that number because most people are actually rushing in to go and see their famous, whoever they paid to go see, and not really wanting to stop. So we were actually glad we got that sample complete.
Any other questions or thoughts? Well, one final just reminder to everyone, we are having the alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs section reception tomorrow evening, 6:30. And again, if you are a member of the section or not, we invite you to get involved. You know, actually, it was in 2006, I believe, that the Governing Council of the American Public Health Association had a resolution presented in front of it that asked APHA to host all of its meetings from that point forward in 100% smoke-free cities. And in large part, that was why New Orleans last year was so important. We were going back to New Orleans because we were supposed to be there the year that Katrina hit, and APHA couldn't be there. So we finally returned then in 2014, and APHA knew that they couldn't go back again until it was 100% smoke-free. And so that's another big reason why I think APHA as an organization, first of all, of course, supported it as a part of public health, but then because they really couldn't go back. And, you know, we want to go back to New Orleans, right? That's a place to have a meeting. So if your city is not yet smoke-free, I'm sure we could get APHA support and other APHA members to support your campaign. Follow the leadership of this wonderful campaign that happened in smoke-free New Orleans. Please join me in thanking our panelists for their hard work and their presentation today.